talking about? What you talking about? What you talking about? Hello, once again, it is Max Boxing Radio. I am Corey Erdman alongside Steve Kim. And Steve, the first episode has come and gone, and we probably have about as many paying customers as Dawson and Hopkins do for the pre-order on the pay-per-view. So it's a success so far.
Corey, I got to tell you, I don't know if you were able to watch the HBO version of the broadcast on Saturday.
Yeah.
They did an interview with Chad Dawson and Bernard Hopkins in between the first fight and the Martinez fight. Now, I don't want to say Chad Dawson is boring or didn't exactly inspire a lot of passion, but Vanilla Ice Cream called and it said, good Lord, that guy is playing.
Yeah, it's just, it's unfortunate, and I'm talking to Chad later on today, and
I mean,
well, no, but I am talking to him, and it's something that I'll bring up, and by today, I mean Wednesday, the day that we're recording this, and in a way, it's kind of HBO's fault that they continue to interview a guy that maybe just doesn't have that kind of pizzazz. I mean, it's not Chad Dawson's fault that he isn't TV-friendly both on the mic or in the ring. That's just the kind of guy he is. And unfortunately, this is the one walk of life where you are criticized for being the meek family man. And anywhere else, we would praise this guy as being the wholesome American hero, but this is boxing, and unfortunately, we want lunatics sometimes.
Well, you know what the funny thing is, though? I think we could handle his demeanor outside the ring. He is who he is. But I think one of the problems that he has is that demeanor, Corey, it translates or correlates to his demeanor inside the ring.
Sure.
Because the name Chad Dawson doesn't evoke a lot of passion. And Chad Dawson, when he fights, he kind of like punches a clock. He's very good at what he does. But pay-per-view is about stars. And Bernard Hopkins, to me, has built a cachet. The problem is he needs a dance partner. And I thought Dawson Hopkins, to me, is a good HBO-level fight, if it's not going to be at least Gaddy Ward. You can still say to yourself, that's a certain standard or a level of fight that you can at least try to appreciate, right? Problem is, in this economy, coming off Mayweather-Ortiz, and by the way, one of these months they will release pay-per-view figures, it is going to be a very difficult sell, in my opinion, Corey, to ask people to fork over another $60 to $65, and Kathy Duva right now, we'll get into this more next week, she's vindicated because she actually got that event thrown out of Newark because she didn't want that market being contaminated with ticket giveaways and discounts. Guess what they're doing at the Staples Center next week, Corey? Ticket giveaways and discounts.
Oh, yeah, the 20% off. We got the email, Steve. and you know, I think all of the criticism is valid when it comes to the promotion, when it comes to HBO and whether this belongs on pay-per-view. And as you mentioned last week, this is sort of the last gift from Ross Greenberg. I just think that sometimes this criticism gets directed towards the fighter, and in this case, none of this is Chad Dawson's fault because it's not like he's been ducking and dodging people or demanding that he's on pay-per-view. As you mentioned, he goes in, he punches the clock, he does his thing. If you don't like him or if you don't find him exciting enough, that is a different issue, but I don't think that the criticism should be heaped on him. Similar line of thinking, Steve, the broadcast that you mentioned, Sergio Martinez, Darren Barker, I think that you and I both agree that Sergio Martinez didn't look terrific in there, but I think you and I might disagree a little in that I think that Darren Barker did himself a favor. I think that he actually helped himself moving forward in terms of what he could do and fights he can get in this division.
You know, Corey, it's interesting. I don't actually disagree with that. I think from a European perspective at that level, because he was a European middleweight champion, I think he comes home a conquering hero in many respects with the moral victory. And I'm going to say this right now. If I had to reincarnate myself as a boxer in my next life, I want to come back as a British boxer, because if you exceed very low expectations and just survive more rounds than people think and maybe win a round or two more than what is expected of you, it seems as though they will build statues of you and write songs of lore and poetry. Darren Barker, I thought, fought well. I thought he was very competent. But go back to what we said last week, Corey. We are not one of these people that was, quote, unquote, cruelly dismissed, as I heard one British media member put it. We said he's a tall, lanky boxer who was competent with good skills, a pretty good skill set, quick feet, could go in and out, and this was going to go rounds. Corey, that's exactly what happened. Where I think we disagree is I only gave him one or two rounds. I thought he did enough to neutralize Sergio Martinez, maybe expose some of the fundamental flaws, but I have to be honest, as I'm watching this, and I've watched the fight two times now, he's doing a lot to make the rounds close. But Corey, outside of maybe, I believe, the fourth, I did not put a lot of innings with the ledger, and I said to myself, Darren Barker won that round. I thought he won respect, but I don't think he ever truly threatened Sergio Martinez.
Yeah, no, I don't think that he was ever threatened. Now, I did give him a couple rounds, and maybe I was doing the opposite. Maybe I was giving him the benefit of the doubt, because there was a lot of times when Sergio was there with his hands down and looking for that opening, and obviously, eventually he found that. I just wouldn't go so far as to say that this fight wasn't competitive, because to say that it wasn't competitive is to say that Sergio was dominating each and every round, and I just don't think that was the case. I think there was a lot of standstill in each and every round, but again, I think that Darren Barker handled himself well, and at least he didn't. Those stamina issues that we worried about last week, and we talked about how he looked in the Domenico Spada fight when his hands started to drop, those didn't present themselves. But Steve, I think a lot of that had to do with Sergio just not ever pressing that pace, and that's something I thought that if he wanted to get Darren Barker out of there, if Sergio just wanted to let his hands go, I think that he could have caused those issues to present themselves, but he just never forced that issue at all, Steve.
You know, you have to give some of that credit to Barker because he slowed down the pace.
Sure.
And when you're a boxer and you want to control the center of the ring and you're the taller guy, and I thought his height would be an issue and his length, and it was, because he does have an educated, quick left hand. And he came right up the middle, and he was also very guarded. The slowing of that pace and the cadence and all that other stuff that we talk about, that has to be given a lot of credence in terms of, did Barker fight a strategic fight that was smart and intelligent? Yes, he did. He also was very judicious in his punch output, which I thought was one of the problems, though, because even though he put himself in position to win the fight, as Emmanuel Stewart pointed out, I agree with Larry Merchant also, though. That has to come with the second aspect, and that is actually moving your hands. And I was also told this by Lou DiBella in confidence last week before the fight. Sergio Martinez is 37 years old, and one of the reasons why, Corey, his fight was backed up this summer. Because remember, originally he was supposed to fight in July and then August. And the reason why they didn't have much of a problem with this fight taking place October 1st, there are a lot of nagging injuries in relationship to Matavia. And he's a guy, I don't want to say he's breaking down, but there comes a stage at every athlete's life where those 15-day DL stints become 30-day DL stints, and the injuries become a little bit more nagging. I mean, football players talk about it all the time. By the seventh year in the league, when they wake up on that Monday or Tuesday morning, that they get out of bed a little bit slower and they feel that game a little bit more. I think Martinez is at that stage now that while I talk about he should be fighting 3-4 times a year, he's probably more realistically going to fight twice a year because that's what his body can handle. And, Corey, moving forward here, with Sergio Martinez, I think there's a certain conundrum. Do you agree with me? There are actually good fights you could make that would hold a lot of interest, whether it's Matthew Macklin, whether it's Andy Lee, whether it's Dmitry Pirog. The problem is those fights are going to take place in America on HBO in front of very, very small or relatively small crowds. But if you place those fights in Europe, those are legitimately big events. But we know the way the business is, and unfortunately what we saw Saturday night, I think, is the norm with as it relates to Sergio Martinez.
It is the norm, and it'll be interesting to see if they'll take that leap, Steve, and put one of these fights in Ireland, in Britain, if they do go ahead and face a guy like Matthew Macklin, who I would assume is the leading candidate even before Andy Lee, because I think that Lou still has some HBO money to make on a guy like Andy Lee, or at least some free fights to be had, some free television slots, just continuing with him. Or if they take the safe way and continue just taking that money and doing it in Atlantic City, not losing anything, because the gate, as you and I know, Steve, it looks bad on television. It should be given more credence. But when it comes to the bottom line of a promoter, if you already have money from a network, the gate really means nothing. Those numbers are almost irrelevant.
You know where it does matter, though? To a guy like Bob Arum. Because I know the way Bob
yep.
is. And when Bob sees this on TV and he hears the reports of the discounts and the flat-out giveaways, and don't let anyone fool you, I know people that were there. I knew people that were there for the Pavlik era that was short-lived, and, of course, Arturo Gatti. That arena was dead, and it was sad to see. And Bob Arum looks at this, who has a Miguel Cotto or Manny Pacquiao or a Chavez, and he'll say stuff like, "Did you see that arena? It was empty. Who the hell wants to see that guy?" So when you have a situation like that where the atmosphere is devoid of any electricity, that will become leveraged against you, and that's the bottom line. There is a market for Sergio Martinez, I believe, in Europe. The only real quandary that they have is, as lucrative as that may be, it may not match the welfare checks being written to Lou DiBella and Samson Lekowitz. And I think they're going to have some decisions to make here. And I'm not so sure where they really go. There's a lot of talk that Andy Lee, who was victorious, gaining revenge against Brian Vera, Corey, they may fight each other on St. Patrick's Day weekend in New York, and then you match up Sergio Martinez with someone else. So in other words, you pick up the collateral interest of St. Patrick's Day, but you have to continue to build Sergio Martinez because, Corey, one of my pet peeves is the whole get on HBO twice, collect a welfare check, don't build a draw, but continue to basically beg guys like Miguel Cotto for fights. Corey, to me, that is not promoting.
No, it's not. And you know what? You mentioned how gates that look like that are irritating to a guy like Bob Arum. You could take this a step further. I mean, we could extend this conversation forever. This is the problem that pro wrestling has when it comes to promoters putting on shows that draw absolutely nobody. We're talking about independent promoters. And boxing is very much the same model in that you have independent promoters but the overall, there is no brand identity to boxing. You know, people don't go, the casual fan doesn't go because they see Top Rank on the bill. They see boxing. And if they see boxing in empty arenas, it looks bad on the sport, and it also drives the market value down because, let's say, if Lou DiBella has a fight in Atlantic City, puts it in the hall, 1,000 people come, and they're giving away tickets in the casino. Well, if Bob Arum or someone else has a fight in Atlantic City 2 months later, and they're not giving tickets away because they are trying to promote, people are going to wonder, well, they're going to go to the casino thinking they're going to get freebies. They're not, and it just drives that market value down. So I see your point, how it's detrimental in the long run. It's just that, as you mentioned, it's just the safe play for promoters to take the easy money and run away with it and not worry about the promotion.
You know, Corey, to expound upon that point, I get into an argument all the time with boxing insiders, and there are some who believe that Sergio Martinez is quote-unquote important to HBO to have because of his overall ability and his talent. And I say, okay, I don't disagree. If he is one of the top five fighters in the world, there should be a home for him on HBO, especially in light of the fact, to his credit, he is not avoiding people. He is being avoided. That is undeniable.
Yes.
Okay. But if you're going to have him on HBO, then you go to the point, is what is his real value? Certainly to a certain, he belongs at a certain tax bracket. You're on HBO, you're fighting relatively tough guys, but are you really worthy of $1.5 million if you can't even sell 4,000 legitimate seats? And that's the question. I've always said, I don't have a problem with a lot of guys being on HBO, but you have to expand this argument to add this comment, but at what price? And, Corey, if you bring down that price across the board into more or less economic reality, something that really reflects their market value in this country, then you will start to see guys say, wait a minute, I could be on HBO, but I could make a little bit more money because of the gate or something more commensurate with what I'm really worth in Europe. then you'll start to see guys take other options. But till that whole paradigm become a little bit more in touch with what's actually going on, you're going to have guys like Sergio Martinez, who he might be able to sell 25, 30,000 tickets against Daniel Gill in Australia, which would be a huge event. He won't do it because if HBO says, you know, we're not going to Australia and you need to fight someone here in Atlantic City once again, this is what we're stuck with.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great discussion to have about how if the market value were just brought down or the going rate when it comes to HBO fights were just lowered a little bit. So instead of the $1.5 million, if HBO said, you know what, we're only going to pay you $500,000, guys would be forced to fight more often, and we would theoretically have better fights. I'm just not going to be the one, Steve, to tell a fighter or a guy who gets punched in the face for a living to take a pay cut. You know, if it happens, terrific. I'm just not going to be that guy.
Corey, the onus is not on those who benefit from
it. Of course not.
And I've always thought that the criticism of Andre Berto, who's become the poster child of everything that's wrong with the real HBO, Heyman Boxing Organization, and I've made this point clear, do not blame Al Heyman. That's his job, to get his clients the best deal possible.
Yep.
Do not blame the fighter, who absolutely deserves to get whatever he can. This
absolutely.
Is the entertainment business. It's not fair, okay? I'm sorry, but athletes and performers, because of the demand for their services, are going to be paid more than school teachers. And that is unfair, but that's life. The onus is on those who enable it, which is, and the people who write the checks here so blithely is HBO. And we go back to Andre Berto real quick. When he fought at Biloxi with a few hundred people against an unknown European who was a pretty solid guy, Jean Zavec, he got right around $750,000. Now, I'm not saying that Berto Zavec shouldn't have been on HBO, because I thought it was a fairly decent fight, at least by Berto standards.
Sure.
Again, I asked this question, but was it worth that price tag? Again, Corey, it's like this. If you are in the free agent market, I call it the Gilmesh theory. I remember when Gilmesh about 5 years ago signed this ridiculous deal with the Kansas City Royals, and he got paid like $55 million. And Gilmesh was just basically a second-line starter. He was never going to be an ace on a good team. So you pay that way, but you don't pay him like he's Justin Verlander. So you go back to the perceived value of a fight and the actual value of a fight, and that's one of the things in the post-Ross Greenberg era that I really believe that HBO has to focus on. Yes, you want to focus in and give guys like Sergio Martinez a chance to shine. The question again, what are they worth?
Well, this could honestly be an episode on its own, Steve. But, I mean, there's so much else in the world of boxing that we could talk about here. And particularly two guys who always earn their worth, whatever that might be, and two guys who can also put people in seats. Talking about Rafael Marquez and Toshiaki Nishioka, who put on a fairly good fight on one of the biggest, or certainly the biggest, actually, and one of the longest top-ranked live cards of the year. Nishioka with another strong performance in sort of what you and I speculated would happen, that he took control in the second half of the fight and there just wasn't anything in the tank from Marquez. He didn't have those answers anymore. The question now is, where do both of these guys go? We've heard rumors about a possible matchup with Nonito Donaire for Nishioka after a fight with Jorge Arce. But for Rafa Marquez, I mean, he didn't look bad enough, Steve, in this fight against really the best fighter there is out there, active at 122, for me to say that he absolutely has to go away. I'm not concerned for his well-being in the squared circle yet.
Well, Rafa Marquez can beat a lot of guys, but at this stage of his career, I think it's been shown he'll be competitive. He'll even be exciting at times against Juanma Lopez and Nishioka. He does not have 36 minutes left in him, and I've said this about older fighters. They are still themselves as they age. They're not themselves for 36 minutes anymore. And Rafa Marquez, for six rounds, I thought did a very nice job of controlling the center of the ring, using a jab, and being very judicious with his punch output. I think he realizes his age and the mileage on the odometer. But I thought the last three rounds, I really liked Nishioka's performance because I thought he made a pretty good statement and he was entertaining. And the last two, three rounds, he sat down and he banged away and he was in and out and he started to come hard with a good straight left. And Marquez, again, showed that customary Marquez heart and grit. And Nishioka, to me, has put himself in position where if he's not going to fight Donaire next, I certainly think he is going to be an option in 2012. And as for Marquez, you know, it is interesting because there's a lot of wear and tear, but he can still beat a certain amount of guys. And we know this about boxers, that there's that old saying about soldiers, they don't die, they just fade away. Well, that's the case with most boxers, Corey. I think Marquez will make one more run at this. And ask yourself this, on that night, what we saw October 1st, Corey, does that version of Rafael Marquez still beat a fair share of other guys?
Absolutely. And yeah. And not only that, but let's take him out of any sort of title contention right now. Let's forget about that, because that is probably the case for Rafael Marquez. If you're top rank and you're Marquez and the Marquez brothers, who are now sort of kind of in the promotional game at the same level that that every fighter is at this point, there are still exciting fights to be made, both on their own or using Marquez in that kind of role where, you see him on undercard pay-per-view, undercards and whatnot. I mean, tell me you can't make an exciting fight between Rafa Marquez and a guy like Arce or Mahrez if you were back at 22, Wilfredo Vasquez Jr., Jonathan Oquendo if you want a Puerto Rico kind of Mexico matchup. There are fights out there for Marquez to be had, and I think that given the Marquez pride, the Mexican fighting pride, he's going to want to go out on top anyway, so I think we will get one of those fights, and I think there are a lot of them that people will enjoy. He's still of great value to television boxing and can provide a lot of entertainment if he still wants to do it.
Yeah, and this is where, again, going back to Barker, I thought Marquez, at his advanced age, took many more chances to actually win the fight than Barker. And that's the point that I tried to make on Saturday night and throughout the weekend. This is not an indictment of Barker, but really, as much praise as he was getting, you know, and maybe this is because of the platforms these fights were on, I was saying to myself and screaming out loud on Twitter, guys, Marquez was much more valiant. Because while Barker really focused in on surviving, and for the most part he did, Marquez actually just laid it out there and was willing to go out on his shield for the most part. He just didn't have enough to really step on the gas pedal. And you're right, Marquez to me still has a value. Right now, he is looked upon as an aged fighter, but certainly not a shot one, and he could still punch. And I've been taught this from people in the gym. The first thing you lose is your legs. The second thing probably is your chin. The one thing you don't really lose is heavy hands. If you can punch, you will punch to the day you die, and that's one thing that Marquez can still do, is at least give the threat of an offensive arsenal. And Corey, if you go back to that fight, for the first 6-7 rounds, Nishioka was very, very respectful, because he knew if he ran into one of those straight rights or those big left hooks, he was going to lose that title. And I thought he was very smart in terms of working his way into the fight, stepping it up, and in the last 9 minutes, really quickening the pace. And it really was a very good crescendo to what was a very good, solid prize fight.
It was. And the other thing I liked is that as Nishioka started to take control, and you mentioned he was very measured and very patient in his attack, he started to unveil different things in his arsenal that he wasn't taking chances with. Around the 6th round was probably the first time that you saw a right hook from Nishioka. He was almost exclusively throwing jabs and straight lefts. Suddenly you saw him take some things out, and he tossed a couple uppercuts in there as well. He's very smart. He's very smart about what he does, and I mentioned that he's not your typical Japanese sort of quick in-and-out flurry and get-out-of-there fighter. He has some more ripples to his game, and he's a little bit slippery, and he did make things very difficult for Marquez. And it wasn't the good style matchup that a lot of people were thinking of when it came to Marquez for him against Nishioka. I don't think, when we talk about style matchups, that Nishioka is in for a very good one against Nonito Donaire, because I don't think that Nishioka would take, let's say, the Darren Barker approach and just try to survive against Nonito Donaire. I think that he's not a runner, and he would be there trying to trade, and I don't think he wins that battle against Nonito.
You know, he probably would be an underdog, but I don't think he gets blown out of there. And I'll tell you why. Number one, he is southpaw, and that is always an issue.
Yep.
Okay, no matter how good a guy is. And Donaire, a lot of people believe he's one of the premier prize fighters in the sport. I don't disagree, but before we all anoint Nonito Donaire, who I like a lot, let's be honest about this. Much of this is based on potential, a lot of the plaudits. He had this great victory against Fernando Montiel. He's looked dominant in his recent form. He looks like he could grow all the way into a legitimate, strong 130-pounder. But right now, let's hold our horses. He's still got Narvaez, who I think is going to be a difficult little guy. He's a plucky, gutty, tough, hard-nosed guy. Then he gets back into reality of how good can he be in 2012. And the one thing about Nishioka that I like, and he showed this against Marquez, I think he realized, against an older fighter who can still punch, you cannot work in a straight line. And the one thing Nishioka did was, I thought he worked angles very well, had very, very good pivots, never really provided a fastball right down the pipe. And I think the angles that he's going to provide with anybody he faces, and I think he is going to have to really box against Donaire, who even though he'd be moving up in his first fight at 122, if it is Nishioka next, Donaire is the bigger guy. There's no doubt. He might be the superior puncher. But Nishioka is a solid guy, and he's probably been the best guy at this division for at least a year or two. He has not lost since 2004. I don't think that is really any means a blowout. I think it's actually a very tough fight, and it's the type of victory that down the line, when you look at Donaire years down the line, if he projects and he lives up to his potential and his hype, that you say to yourself, Nishioka, that was certainly one of the feathers in his cap. And let's hope that fight happens, because there are a lot of options for Donaire, I believe, should he get past Narvaez on October 22nd.
Well, let's move backwards on the clock, looking back to Saturday, Steve, and let's go all the way over to Germany. Gabriel Campillo and Carl Murat in a debatable decision, and this is one of the fun things about midday boxing, is that all the boxing fans are hanging around watching college football and also talking about the fights, and this one sparked plenty of debate. Do you think that Campillo was ripped off in this fight a little bit? Because it's been a common theme. It was something that Steve Bunce was talking about on his way to the ring. What did Campillo do wrong to get the shaft against Shumanov? And you know, Campillo never seems to do enough to convince the row of judges that he's in front of to get these big victories, and it happened again on Saturday.
Well, compared to what happened with Shumanov, he got justice this
yes.
time. Here, this was, a draw, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, don't ever let anyone tell me, or you, that the first Shumanov fight does not exist, because I have a copy of it.
Yes.
And the Shumanov people basically tried to expunge that copy from ever getting out into the public, because it was one of the worst robberies I have ever seen.
It was atrocious.
I'm talking like Whitaker against Jose Luis Ramirez. That's how bad it was. And in 24 rounds against Shumanov, in my not-so-humble opinion, I thought he won at least 19 or 20 rounds.
Yep.
What happened there to me is a travesty. Here's the thing about Campillo that puts him in these quandaries, though. He's the greatest left-handed slap hitter since Rod Carew. I mean, he will go out there, and he's like a little hornet's nest, and he'll just peck away, and it's like a swarm of bees. But he is not a power puncher, but he's got a fairly entertaining style because he hangs in the pocket, but he doesn't hit you very hard. And when he gets hit hard, you could really almost see it, and he got rattled a couple times in the late stage of this fight. Listen, I thought he won this fight, but I also believe he gave openings in between dominating a lot of rounds where he got shook up by Murat, and it gave judges the psychological or physical excuse to say, you know what, that round was close enough that I could give it to the other guy. I thought he won the fight 7-5, but you know this, Corey, the exchange rate in boxing when you go to foreign lands, sometimes when you win 7-5 or 8-4, that means you're going to have to settle for a draw. And so in that sense, he's lucky. But yeah, I think that Campillo's temperament and his style lends itself to being the type that he's always going to be on the short side of the stick.
Yeah, he's the Brett Gardner of modern boxing, and you know that's probably also the reason why he's not a guy like Shumanov who's getting TV dates and whatnot in North America. Is because of that slapping style. And well, first of all, he can't win these fights because of the judges. That's number one.
Yeah.
But number two, a fight like this, if you just look at the tempo and the action back and forth, Steve, this was a very good fight. Campillo Murat was a very good fight. The thing that kept it from being great, as Scott from Bad Left Hook pointed out on Twitter, was just the fact that Campillo isn't a very solid puncher. There wasn't a lot of clean punches, hard punches coming from him. If he sat down on some of those, Steve, this would have been an absolute war.
You know, I like Campillo, and I'll go on record right now as saying it. And he'll be avoided. I don't think he'll ever get these fights because of his style. If you put Mr. Campillo on an equal footing in America against Tavoris Cloud or Jean Pascal, I would pick him to win the fight. Again, that doesn't mean he'd get the decision, but I think his hunt and peck style, where he's very consistent and he kind of swarms you like a pack of bees, I think he is a top three or four light heavyweight for whatever that's worth. But the fact that he's always a road fighter and he's never going to really knock anybody out, and you know, and people say that all the time, if he would sit down on his punches, you know, folks, he is what he is, and one of the reasons why he can be so volume centric in terms of his offensive attack is because he doesn't sit down.
Correct, yes.
It's a more fuel efficient style. I mean, if you're not taking hard cuts all the time, guess what? You are going to have more energy, and that's part of the appeal. See, I don't mind guys that may not be great heavy-handed punchers. I don't expect every guy to be Bob Foster or Tommy Hearns. But certain guys like Juan Diaz, I've always found a little bit entertaining because they make it up with volume, and they hang in the pocket, and they're very gutty, and they're tough. And that's what Campillo does, is that he swarms you. And Campillo's the type of guy that I always feel sorry for because of the fact he has to be Mel Gibson, a.k.a. the Road Warrior. You know this, and I know this, Corey. A guy like him, from the time they touch bells, he's already down 2-0 on the scorecards.
Yeah,
that's the reality.
And I agree with you, Steve. I like volume punchers that aren't going to knock anyone out, because you know what that could produce? A 12-round absolute war, right? Because no one's going to get knocked out. I like value for my entertainment, and he's sort of like the buffet of fighters as well. You get everything, you get all kinds of stuff. It's not all of it's very good, but you're going to be stuffed by the end of it. It's not the steak, but you get everything you could ever want. Now, Murat, on the other hand, I think would have the style that would get run over by a guy like Tavoris Cloud, and I said that right away in this fight.
Yeah.
I've seen Murat fight a couple times, but I think he's sturdy enough, but he's really damn hittable, and he's going to put his guard up when the guy throws, but that guard was being split by Campillo, mind you, with accuracy, but still, a guy like Cloud would just blow him out of the water. So, in a way, maybe it's beneficial that he didn't win this eliminator and possibly get a shot at Cloud. But alas, it's unfortunate that that Campillo didn't get the nod in this one. Another questionable decision on that card in Germany, Steve Cunningham losing his cruiserweight strap to Juan Pablo Hernandez in what a lot of people are saying was a complete ripoff. Hernandez drops him hard in the first round. Cunningham was then coming on and was pressing the action and had Hernandez against the ropes a lot before a cut over Hernandez's right eye eventually stopped the fight. Steve, a cut that wasn't bleeding, really, at the time of the stoppage. What was your opinion of what unfolded?
Well, you know, I talked to Steve Cunningham, who's still in Germany on Monday, and he was still a bit bewildered, but then he wasn't. I mean, let's face it, you want to talk about another guy who will perpetually be a road fighter is an American cruiserweight. There's no market in our country for the 200-pound division, and essentially he was forced to sign with Sauerland to get these opportunities. And even with Sauerland, he's the B-side in fights like Juan Pablo Hernandez, who's trained by Uli Wegner, who's the house trainer of Sauerland events. If going to the fight itself, there's two things, though. Before we get to what happened in the fifth, sixth rounds and the way the fight was pulled, I believe that Juan Pablo Hernandez going into this fight had a legitimate puncher's chance. And it turned out that he really did. He knocked down and really buzzed and dazed Steve Cunningham in the first. Well, this has shades of Tyson Douglas in a sense that I believe that Mickey Van, I don't think it was intentional, I don't think it was any corruption, but I thought he gave him a version of the long count. After the mandatory 8 count was administered, he really gave Steve Cunningham some valuable time to kind of settle himself. That being said, what happened in the fifth, sixth rounds, you could see this coming. And Steve Cunningham knew that, hey, I know the politics here. And he was coming on. He was hitting him with body shots. He became the physical dominator within that fight. And you just knew as soon as the fight reached the fourth round, if the going got tough, if they left that opening for Juan Pablo Hernandez to basically steal this title, and again, I don't put that on the fighter. I think the administrators a lot of times have a lot more to say about this than the actual participant. You knew exactly what would happen, and I thought Juan Pablo Hernandez definitely won the first round. You scored that 10-8. I thought the second round was close. Close enough, though, that Cunningham was not going to get the round. However, 3, 4, 5, and 6, every single round, Steve Cunningham won, and he started to surge. And you knew as soon as the doctor came in, Corey, I had that ominous feeling that, uh-oh, here it comes. And, Corey, it came.
It came, yeah. It's unfortunate because Hernandez is also a fighter who is simply based in Germany. And really, this is the one thing that's keeping me from thinking it's the old boxing conspiracy theory, right, where the promoter is telling the judges that you got to rip this guy off, because Cunningham is a Sauerland fighter as well, right? He's there in Germany, and you could make the same case that it's in their rooting and financial interest to have Steve Cunningham win that fight at all costs. I think the one thing I take away from the fight, I mean, all the controversy aside, is that Steve Cunningham has some real difficulty with southpaws and with picking up that straight left hand. This is the second, not second straight fight, because Cunningham's had a fight in the interim, but this fight and the Troy Ross fight, you saw him struggle mightily with picking up that left hand.
No, and here's another thing. That chin can be dented.
Yes.
If we go all the way back to the Adamek fight, he hit the floor 3 times. With that being said, going back to whatever conspiracy theory you want to use, I found it interesting that Steve told me that in this instance, now this is a first. He says, I don't blame Colley or Wilford Sauerland here. And I'm like, you don't? They're the promoters here. He says, I blame Yuli Wegner and one of the operations director at that company. I have never actually seen the trainer be blamed for pulling strings. And he explained to me that Yuli Wegner, who was a leading trainer out there in that part of the world, also trains a guy by the name of Marco Huck,
Cunningham
just happened to beat. And he believes that Uli Wegner wants no part of a rematch with Huck and Cunningham, and that he has a lot of sway over there. You know, in this country, we have a lot of influential trainers ourselves, guys like Emmanuel Stewart and Freddie Roach. But I can honestly tell you, I have never once said to myself, boy, that Freddie Roach, he has sway over the California Commission, and if this fight's close, you know Freddie's going to pull strings. I just found that interesting that Steve Cunningham did not direct the finger at the people running the promotional company, but the people that maybe work with inside of it. I thought that was very odd, and I just found that to be a little bit dubious, and I'm actually writing a story on Cunningham tonight later for Max Boxing, and I'm trying to get some comments from anyone at Sauerland Promotions, because in my mind, blaming the promoter for essentially, I don't want to say fixing a fight, but helping the result along, I think is almost unprecedented.
It happens all the time, though. And you know what? Maybe I'm not going to tell you what to write, Steve, but I'm curious to find out why there is this idea that Marco Huck, because of the Cunningham's loss, is absolutely the best cruiserweight in the world when he has a loss to Cunningham and what could have been a loss to Denis Lebedev. We've sort of anointed Marco Huck as the number one guy in the cruiserweight division, and there's stuff out there that could maybe suggest that he doesn't, that he's ducking fights, that they're sort of guiding him along in the right directions. I don't know. I don't look at Marco Huck as the number one guy in the division, and if that's who we decide is the best guy at 200 and below, then he's probably the weakest division leader in boxing.
Here's what I think about Marco Huck. I don't think he's the best cruiserweight in the world. I think the perception is based on the fact he's the toughest cruiserweight to beat in that setting.
Right.
See, I think there's a distinct difference.
Yes.
It's like, certain football teams are, or any sport, they're not all the way the best, but on the home court or the home arena, they're absolutely the toughest to beat. I think that's Marco Huck. You look at Marco Huck, he's a very rugged, crude brawler, okay? But he's not all that skilled in terms of classic fundamental grounding. But in Germany, I'm telling you right now, he's going to get every single break. Okay, the referees are going to be in his favor. He's probably had 2-0 on every scorecard before the first round bell rings, and he's just going to be overall a tough physical bastard to knock off his block. And I think that's where the perception comes. That I don't necessarily think that people think, wow, that guy right there is the heir to Evander Holyfield, because they certainly don't think that, because I don't even think he's nearly in the class of Thomas Adamek. Cunningham's already beat him, but to go over there to Germany and to defeat the Sauerland politics, Corey, that's going to be a tough, tough task.
And it's unfortunate. Well, let's quickly talk about Showbox as well, Steve, before we get into some news and notes, and we take a quick break just to give ourselves a breather here. But Showbox, a very good main event, and this is something that that I predicted last week, and Steve, I'm sure you agree, that that Jose Alusagin and Ali Chiba put on a very good fight. This is what I thought would happen between Alusagin, who I thought could be baited into a good fight, and Chiba, who is typically always in a good fight. It sort of turned out to be the other way around. It was Alusagin who wanted to fight, who wanted to flurry, and turned out to be a very TV-friendly fighter, and something we haven't seen from him before. He was flashy. He had the kind of personality that I think that people would be drawn to if he were given the opportunity to. Maybe not here in the United States, but they'll enjoy watching him on the screen. And all around, a good performance by Alusagin. Nothing at all wrong with what Chiba turned in. I thought he was valiant in the effort. But Steve, there is no way that Eric Morales beats Alusagin. I think he knows that, and there is no way that Eric Morales versus Jose Alusagin ever happens.
Well, I know a guy that'll make sure that never takes place. His name is Jose Sulaiman.
Yep.
Okay? Let's be very honest about it. He's going to get that protection that he gets from Mr. Greenbelt. Alusagin was very fun. He was very active. And I'm watching this fight early on, late Friday night, and I'm saying to myself, there is no way Eric Morales will ever fight him.
Nope.
He's just a bad style. And he's one of those wild guys whose unorthodox manner is probably his greatest strength, because his punches are not exactly coming right down the chute, but he has very good physical strength, and he's in and out. And that right there was a definition of a fun fight. It wasn't a lot of skill. I don't know how world-class it really was, but Alusagin is one of those guys that he needs a sanctioning body in this sense. No one's going to take the risk of fighting him or go through with it unless he is that mandatory. Now, looking ahead into the future, Eric Morales has several options because he's Eric Morales. He's going to either fight Maidana next spring, or he might even fight Amir Khan. With that being said, those are lucrative fights that HBO will buy. I don't believe that HBO, with its current management, will buy Alusagin. I really don't. And I can't see Golden Boy, if Eric Morales is still a moneymaker for them, I can't see them taking the risk of ever fighting this guy. And then the quandary that he has is that he's with, I believe, was it Gary Shaw, I believe, is in partnership with somebody to promote him. He doesn't really have an audience out here. So I think he's certainly achieved something in earning that mandatory position or the number one ranking within the WBC. The question is, Corey, where do they go from here?
Yeah, you're right. He's a Nigerian who fights out of the UK, who now lives in New York. And I think Lou DiBella is actually the other guy who's yeah, partnered with Gary to promote Alusagin. I think the thing is, Steve, I think that HBO would go for Alusagin as an opponent to one of these other guys. It's just that no promoter or fighter is going to pick Alusagin as their opponent. You know, so he's still stuck either way. I think anybody can get a chance as an opponent when it comes to facing a name. It's just, yeah, without the sanctioning body and whatnot, unless he's the champion and,
yeah,
and gets this title and then locks out to get that HBO date, I don't see it being given to him. I do think maybe, you know, you can keep him on Showbox. You can get him on ESPN. I think there are spots for Alusagin. I don't think that, I don't get the sense that he's particularly picky, even though he hasn't been that active. I think that was a case of just waiting out the sanctioning body. But if he is number one and he can just fight and wait for that title to become available, there are certainly spots for him on American television, and I'll be happy to see him on my screen. And the same goes for Ali Chiba as well, especially if he comes back to where he lives in Montreal and fights here in Canada. But Eric Morales, you're right. I think he's just going to fight his mandatory, whoever the WBC allows him to fight. And then, as we've read this week, he wants to go back to 135 and win another world title. And guess what, Steve? They'll probably make up another world title for him to win there. And I can't even complain because it's Eric Morales. That's boxing for you. Steve, hit us with some news and notes before we take a quick break here.
Yeah, this news broke yesterday. I'm sure everyone knows this by now. Emmanuel Stewart and Miguel Cotto are no more citing scheduling difficulties, and Miguel Cotto is coming up with this former Cuban national coach. Corey, no matter what is said here, like most divorces in boxing, I think the real underlying reason is very simple. It's money. If you just look at the history of the time spent between the two, everyone knows when you train with Emmanuel Stewart, you're getting a hired gun who cannot be exclusive, and you're telling me a guy is basically being jettisoned for a fight that took place on October 1st, while your fight takes place December 3rd. That simply doesn't make sense, but both men are trying to be very amicable about this. Also, Tim Bradley late last week signed a deal with Top Rank. Now, that is the great news, that he's going to be on. He's going to be really promoted now. I think eventually he will get Manny Pacquiao and his career resumed. Corey, the bad news is they're fighting Joel Casamayor. Really, guys? That's the best you can do. Also, November 26th, Boxing After Dark. Corey, I think this fight is very close to being negotiated and finalized. Saul Alvarez against Kermit Citron in a fight that I think a lot of people are split on. And also, one last note here. December 10th, Amir Khan, Lamont Peterson. People have known about this fight for a while, and it will take place in Washington, D.C. And, Corey, I don't know if you agree with me on this. I like this move by Golden Boy because Amir Khan is not a star in Las Vegas. I've been to his last two fights. The Mandalay Bay literally had to give away not only tickets but hotel rooms to entice people to get here. Vegas is a very tough market, and I like the fact that they're actually going to do a little bit of a gimmick here, bringing big-time boxing back to Washington, D.C., Lamont Peterson and the heavyweight Seth Mitchell. There's a local pull. I think that's the route they got to go with Amir Khan. Be a little bit of a road fighter, build a cachet in the States, then you can go back to Las Vegas.
I think that's a terrific idea. There's a good boxing community in Washington, D.C. A lot of fighters like to go there to train. It's a shame that there hasn't been a market built for Lamont there really in the past, but it's better late than never. I mean, you might as well bring him there. I still think that anyone who's from a given place, if they fight there, they're going to have that certain pull when it comes to tickets, more than Amir would have had just with his traveling crowd going to Las Vegas.
Yeah, and one other note here. November 19th, I got this information yesterday. If you're a fan of Julio Cesar Chavez in the Lone Star State, you could see him once again. He'll be fighting Peter Manfredo Jr. At the Reliant Arena in Houston, Texas. And this continues a trend. Corey, if you want to rebuild some of the foundation and the roots of boxing in our country, we need to have more and more events in major metropolitan cities like Washington, D.C. and Houston. And I think that Chavez-Manfredo is a fight that I know a lot of people don't like, and people will argue whether it's an HBO-worthy caliber event or not. But I will say this, that arena holds 8,500 people. I think the large majority of tickets will be sold, and they will do a strong rating on HBO that night.
And I can also guarantee that for however long that fight lasts, Steve, it's going to be relatively exciting. It's just the nature of those two fighters. They're going to make for a fun fight. On the other side of the break, we're going to finish off, talk about the Hall of Fame ballot this year, who we think should be in, who we think should be out. Stay tuned for more of Max Boxing Radio. Welcome back to Max Boxing Radio. Corey Erdman alongside Steve Kim. And Steve, the Hall of Fame ballot has been released for this year for the folks in the BWAA. You and I are not two of those people, so we don't actually have votes, but I think we're qualified enough to at least comment on what's going on here, and the trip to Canastota is always a fun one for induction weekend. This year, Thomas Hearns is on the ballot, Darius Mikulchevsky and Mark Tusharp Johnson, the three big names added to the ballot. Steve, in your opinion, I think Hearns is a no-brainer, but what about Tusharp and what about the Tiger? Do you think that they are Hall of Fame worthy?
Well, I'm going to say this right now. I know in baseball there's that tradition where I guess nobody, even Willie Mays, Babe Ruth, and the like, have never had 100% ballots. If you don't vote for Tommy Hearns, for whatever reason, you should never be allowed to vote for any. In fact, you shouldn't even be allowed to vote for president.
Yes.
Okay? As it relates to Mikko Cheski, I think in Europe, the European sector, those precincts, I think Mikko Cheski gets the check mark next to his name. I think he was consistent, he was solid, he was durable. And by the way, I know the folks that just live and die on what HBO says and the Ring magazine ratings. It was not Roy Jones during that era in the late 90s that was the true, real, definitive light heavyweight champion from a lineal perspective. It was Darius Mikko Cheski. That's the reality of it. And he had a very, very solid, long career. And, you know, Mikko Cheski, to me, I think he does get in. But I've always said, if he gets in, shouldn't Virgil Hill? Because Virgil Hill was kind of the American version of Mikko Cheski, wasn't it? Mikko Cheski had Germany. Virgil Hill had Denmark. Or not Denmark, Bismarck, North Dakota.
Yeah.
Right? They were both ticket sellers. They both have some pretty good victories. They both have longevity, which to me is very important. That sometimes, what I call the Don Sutton effect in baseball. Don Sutton, I don't think ever won a Cy Young or won 20 games. But, Corey, for a lot of years, he won 15 to 16 to 17 games and eventually piled up 300 victories, and that's why he's in Cooperstown. I've said I have no problems with Darius Mikko Cheski getting his fist encased in Canastota, but I make the argument that, you know, Virgil Hill, not only did he have a long run at light heavyweight, well, he also had a lot of success at cruiserweight and battled some pretty good big guys. But Mikko Cheski, in my opinion, will get in. The guy that I'm really stumping for this year is one of my personal favorites. He'd be on my Mount Rushmore of favorite slash best fighters that I've ever covered since really being in the sport since 1996, is Marcellus Joseph Too Sharp Johnson, the Jackie Robinson of flyweights. During his day, I always said he was one of the top three fighters in the world, right up there with the likes of Roy Jones. And I've written this before. He is a guy that had a bad gene pool, because if he was 30, 40 pounds bigger, I thought he was better than De La Hoya, Trinidad and Corte, and all those guys. I thought he was a spectacular fighter, Corey. I really do.
And it's unfortunate because, you know, whereas Mikko Cheski, you could sort of make the argument, other than the Roy Jones fight, which probably could have happened, sort of had that shelter in an away country. Johnson was just flat out avoided by fighters. He was one of the most avoided fighters of his time, and it's unfortunate that he didn't have the chance to get in there with a guy like Carbajal or Johnny Tapia, plus the fact that if you turn one of those fights, the first Rafael Marquez fight, which I thought he won, if you turn that into a victory, we don't even have to. Nobody has this discussion at all about Mark Too Sharp Johnson.
Here's the thing about Too Sharp: he was consciously avoided by Tapia and the other guy of Albuquerque that was really big at that time, Danny Romero.
That's right. Yeah.
Don't forget, Too Sharp was the number one contender to Romero, who flat out, I think basically, if I recall correctly, dodged the belt. At that time, both of those men were handled by Cameron Duncan. And Cameron Duncan flat out said, Steve, I knew what was going to happen in those fights. We made sure we never ran into Too Sharp. And going back to Too Sharp, all right, he loses to Marquez in the rematch. I remember Too Sharp telling me, I looked up at the weigh-in and I said to myself, my God, this guy is huge. I got to do this again. And by the way, the first fight with Marquez to me was very shady. The referee took a point literally 30 seconds to go in the fight.
Yep.
And they also changed the scorecards. And I'll never forget Too Sharp telling me he did not find out about what had happened with his decision until he was watching a replay back at the hotel of Boxing After Dark that night when Angel Manfredi fought Julio the Kid Diaz, in one of the more interesting aspects of boxing that I can recall. But as an old man, a year or two later, he beat Fernando Montiel on just guile and hustle alone. And he basically conned this young kid with this slickness. That's how good Too Sharp really was. And it's really a shame that he never had a foil, and he was one of these guys that was stuck in a vacuum. He was from the wrong coast, and he was also the wrong color. And one of the first guys I got to know was Mark, because he was a guy that was signed with Forum Boxing, and he eventually went to Cedric Kushner. But I still remember some of the best performances that I've ever seen live was Mark Johnson at the Great Western Forum back when they had their boxing program, where he would just riddle some very tough, hard-nosed Mexican fighters. And first time I ever really noticed him was he fought a guy by the name of Francisco Tejedor, who had absolutely given Danny Romero fits on HBO, okay? And he was actually winning that fight for about 10 rounds before he got stopped late. Well, a short time later, Too Sharp faces him. ices him in 90 seconds, okay? Then you got another situation where Arthur Flash Johnson, who I remember giving Johnny Tapia absolute fits on ABC, he was not going to win that fight in Albuquerque. A couple of years later, Flash Johnson fights Too Sharp. He goes about 60 seconds. That's how good Too Sharp Johnson really was, and I think he's largely overlooked or ignored or overshadowed for a lot of different reasons. I don't know if he's going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer, but I'm pretty sure that the writers who did their homework will put a check mark next to his name.
Yeah, and keep in mind, this is the Boxing Writers Association of America who is voting, so hopefully they are aware of who an American fighter of the stature of Mark Johnson is. You know, as we mentioned, that Hearns probably gets in. There are a couple names that have been on the ballot for a little while, Steve, and I just wanted to make my case for them. Myung-Woo Yoo, who is one of the greatest Korean fighters of all time, maybe the greatest fighter of all time. In 2010, Young-Koo Chang got in the hall, and he was a light flyweight who made a pile of defenses at 108. And I think Dan Rafael has made this argument in the past as well. If Chang is in the hall, I don't know how Yoo is not. You know, Yoo made 17 successful title defenses at 108. He's basically, you know, you could probably make the argument he's the greatest light flyweight ever, if not
Chiquita Gonzalez.
Yeah, probably maybe Chiquita Gonzalez if you want to put him in there. But in terms of successful title defenses, Yoo is that guy. He had one loss. He avenged that loss. He stayed at 108 pounds for 8 years. And really, if he was Chang's contemporary. And if Chang is in the hall, then Yoo probably has to be. And the other guy I want to make a case for is Coco Kidd, who people have overlooked. You know, we talk about that Black Murderers Row era with Charlie Burley and Holman Williams, and those guys have gotten the hall, but for some reason, Coco Kidd hasn't. And he won the colored welterweight title over Holman Williams. He beat Holman Williams numerous times. He has a draw with Charlie Burley. You know, it's like we sort of discovered that era, took the top two guys, and that was it. But there were more than just those two guys who were fighting at a top level, fighting each other on even terms. And a guy like Coco Kidd, I think, deserves to be in there if the other guys do. Steve, there are lots of names on that ballot, though. The thing is, it's the Barry McGuigan rule. If Barry McGuigan's in the Hall of Fame, I really don't know. We have these arguments as to who we consider to be great fighters, and that's really what we're arguing about here. But really, in terms of the line, the bar that has been set as to who is in the Hall of Fame, it's been set so low that you can make an argument for virtually everybody.
Well, the first name you mentioned, and this goes for all Asian fighters and small fighters.
There are only five of them in the hall, by the way.
Yeah, there's going to be a natural prejudice against them, especially in that era. See, nowadays, no matter where a fighter is from, you can eventually see them either through DVD collectors or the YouTube platform. So there's not a lot of secrets. And if you're not a lazy boxing writer or journalist, you're going to make time out to see these guys. But back in the 70s and 80s and early mid to late 90s, it was hard to get footage of these guys. So you never got to see them. I mean, wasn't KSI Galaxy, who perhaps was one of the top five fighters ever from Asia, for years, he did not make the Hall of Fame, if I recall.
Yeah, I think he struggled to get on the ballot for a little while, Steve.
Because I don't think people knew who the hell he was.
Mm-mm.
And like a guy like Chris John, he's not a popular fighter out here, but most real boxing fans have seen some sort of version of Chris John, whether it was that dubious decision against Juan Manuel Marquez and certainly his fight on HBO and pay-per-view against Rocky Juarez. But a lot of those guys, and especially the fighters who fought in the 40s and 50s. I mean, think about this, Corey. There's a lot of footage of Ray Robinson. But you know what? I've always contended, we don't know how good Ray Robinson was unless you were there, because there's no footage of him in his actual prime as a welterweight. A lot of the stuff that we see of Ray Robinson in black and white is the stuff where he lost two steps as a middleweight.
Yep.
But we never saw him fight Tommy Bell when he won his original title at 147 pounds. So if there's not tape or actual video witnessing of Ray Robinson at the welterweight, the guy that you just mentioned, there's probably no footage of him.
Nope.
And that's going to hurt guys like that. And I believe that the fighters of today who care about this stuff, who want to be in the Hall of Fame, I think are actually lucky to be in the era they are now for one reason. that their stuff is going to be seen. There's going to be evidence. There's going to be historical landmarks where we can say to ourselves, we've seen this, this, and this. But a lot of those Asian fighters that are left off that ballot, even Jerry Penalosa, a lot of his fights where he got robbed in South Korea, losing by a point or two under very suspicious circumstances, I don't know of anyone that actually has those fights. So a guy like Penalosa, who may have came along just a little bit too late, and I think was the precursor to Manny Pacquiao, he is also a victim of the fact we don't have a lot of his early footage. And I think that's what holds back a lot of these guys.
Yeah, and nowadays, I don't know that you have the same problem, because I think you can go back and get footage of a lot of guys. I'm talking about the current crop of fighters, but still, I mean, you have people that are voting on these things who only watch what's on HBO. So ultimately, Steve, whoever we see on HBO every single week, they're going to make it into the Hall of Fame one day. And I guess that just legitimizes everything that we complain about when it comes to the past HBO administration and anything that we see moving forward, and that's unfortunate. But Steve, we got to wrap up here. I do want to mention that it's probably going to be a banger of a fight on Showbox between Bulgari and Contreras, so definitely check that out. We'll catch you all guys next time. What you talking about?